with the court scheduled to weigh a case regarding the constitutionality of the policy a week after the election. Trump celebrated the prospect that the Supreme Court would throw out the Affordable Care Act on Sunday, tweeting, quote, would be a big win for the USA. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 79 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, it's 73 degrees and cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering. Please stay safe.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for Black Star News with Milton Alamadi coming up.
Welcome to Black Star News Show on WBAI New York 99.5 FM radio. I am your host, Milton Alamadi. And today, in the first half hour, we're going to be looking at the high cost of speaking truth to power. Last week, we had a conversation with Aaron Kiza about his client, who is a Ugandan author and also a columnist for Black Star News. And his name is Kakwenza Rokadabesheida. Now, he's been arrested two times in recent months, beginning with April and more recently in September, basically for writing two books. One of the books is called The Greedy Barbarian, and it's about an African dictator who turns the nation's treasury into a personal ATM machine for his family. And the second book is called, the second book that actually just wrote after he was released from the first arrest, and that one is called Banana Republic, where writing is treasonous. Last week, he was still locked up. He was tortured by military intelligence in Uganda because of these two books. We announced and promoted a campaign that was global, hashtag Free Kakwenza. Listeners, I'm happy to say that Kakwenza is actually joining us today as we interview him from Uganda on his ordeal. Welcome to the show, Kakwenza.
Thank you, thank you.
Well, let's start from the beginning. How are you feeling physically right now? How are you doing physically, mentally, psychologically?
I cannot say that I'm feeling fine 100%. Maybe I can say that I'm feeling fine like 60%.
Okay, so you continue to heal from the ordeal.
Yeah, but gradually I believe I'll be fine.
Okay, well, it's good to hear that. And while you were detained the first time in April for writing The Greedy Barbarian, you described in the more recent book how you were tortured. Before you get into that, I would like you to tell listeners what kind of bogus charges they brought up to justify your arrest after you were released on bail, after the first arrest. What charges did they bring up against you?
The Trump charges were doing an act which is likely to spread coronavirus.
And this was because you had posted some items on your Facebook page, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
And basically you were challenging the government's lockdown policy, is that correct?
Yes, presidential directives.
Okay, so you're saying this is being used as an excuse to suppress legitimate dissent and opposition in Uganda.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, could you give us an example?
When I was arrested in April, I was taken to the CMY where I was tortured, and the whole interrogation was centered on my novel, A Greedy Barbarian. But when we reached in court, the charges they preferred against me were actually different. I was expecting to be charged with maybe defamation, maybe disturbing the peace of the president. But when they read the charges against me, I was actually surprised to find that they had preferred such charges, that I did an act which was likely to spread coronavirus. I had written an article in the newspaper warning the president that his warped ideas, his warped directives, unconstitutional directives would actually plunge the country into famine, because farmers were restricted from movement, such things.
Right. So the lockdown affected even farmers. So you're saying food production would be affected and it would cause famine. That's what you were saying.
Actually, I was writing on my, basing on my experience, because myself, I'm a farmer.
I see. You're a farmer as well.
Yes.
Okay, so but that's what they mentioned when they finally brought you to court. But while they were torturing you, the only questions they were asking you were about the book, The Greedy Barbarian. First of all,
yes,
it's really hard for many Americans listening to conceptualize how somebody could be arrested by military intelligence. I mean, does the military intelligence service of a country have nothing better to do? That's one part of it. Then number two, to arrest and torture somebody for a fiction book that he wrote. So I want you to tell listeners how you were picked up from your home. Were you in bed? What was happening? And then tell us how they took you away, and describe some of the torture that they committed against you.
The first time?
Yes, the first time in April.
Yeah. The first time they came to my home, they besieged the whole home. They surrounded the home. Some of them forced themselves inside the house. They had guns. They were all equipped. Some of them were in military uniform. Some of them were in civilian clothes. So they come in the house. I was actually in bed sleeping. No, I was not sleeping. I was doing some work on bed. It was around noon. Mm-hmm. So my wife comes to the bedroom to call me, to tell me that we are under house arrest. So as I prepared myself to actually wrap myself with a towel, they are already inside the bedroom, telling me to dress up and I go. I ask them, where is the arrest warrant? Where is, how do you arrest me like this? You're not supposed to be arresting me, because police is the one who's supposed to arrest me. So they threatened to take me when I'm naked. They threatened to hit my head. So I accept. They handcuffed me, they chained my legs, and I walked to where they had parked the car, and they drive me to the chieftains of military intelligence.
Okay, so your house is surrounded by how many soldiers, roughly? Can you...
Around 17.
17 soldiers, because
yes,
of writing, a book. You did not threaten to overthrow the government or anything. You just wrote a fiction book, and they sent 17 soldiers.
I just wrote
soldiers.
A fiction book, and actually I did not know that book would bring me trouble, would attract the attention of the military. So.
Okay, so tell us now, they took you in to captivity. I think you describe how you were blindfolded, and then tell us what they did to you.
So they put me in the vehicle, and they drive me to Kampala, that is the capital city,
right?
Around 120 kilometers from my residence. So before we reach the military barracks, they cover my head with a beanie. They blindfold me so that I don't see where I'm being taken. They take me, they dump me in the torture chamber. And I spent around 6 days in the torture chamber when they are torturing me, beating me, when they are covering me, and I could not see anything. I could not, when they are interrogating me, I could not see anyone. Just they would pick me from the toilet. They had locked me in the toilet. That is why I spent some days. They would pick me from there, tell me to cover my head, and they take me for interrogation. And some nights they would hang me. They would chain my arms, my hands, and legs, and they hang me on the rails or stairs.
Like an animal.
Yes, that actually happened twice. Then oftentimes in the toilet, that is where I had been incarcerated, in the toilet, they would actually hang me still in the toilet. They would, toilet walls, they have some jutting iron bars, supports, whereby right. they leave you to stand in the toilet, then they chain your legs on the toilet seat. Then they handcuff you on the jutting iron bars from the wall. So they just leave you to be like that and you spend the night there.
Unbelievable. Now, in the second book that you wrote, Banana Republic, you describe some of the torture also. You said you were made to slide on a pool of water, which simulated drowning, and that is most people would call that waterboarding. And you describe being beaten until you lost consciousness. You described at one point you were ordered to eat your own feces in the toilet where you were spending. And you're saying right now, are you able to sleep at night? I mean, how are you dealing with the psychological
right now, I have not received any psychological counseling. I wanted to first heal, they damaged my kidneys, beating me. They beat me in the back, and, when I had the inflammations all over my body was swollen. My kidneys were damaged, so I had to first heal properly before going for psychological counseling. They punched me in the eyes, so they covered my eyes still, and when I got out, my eyesight was very poor. Actually, up now it is very poor. I'm supposed to be going for eye surgery, I think, next week. So sometimes I'm sleeping and I feel like I'm getting a stroke. The psychological, I'm not yet fine. Even my body is still healing. I'm not yet okay, but I'll be fine.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. So eventually you were released after that first arrest in April, I believe it was April 13, after 3 weeks on bail. And then you wrote...
I was taken to a kangaroo court after my lawyers had written, after the high court had instructed the security agencies to produce me either alive or dead. That is a writ of habeas corpus.
Right.
So they took me to a kangaroo court. They remanded me to prison where I spent around 3 weeks. Yes, no, around 15 days, yes.
Right.
Then I was given bail, of course. So I kept on reporting to court, every after 2 weeks, would go to court.
Right.
So that is when I sat down and I said, no, let me document this, let me document my ordeal. So I narrated my ordeal in another book. That is a Banana Republic, where writing is treasonous. So after narrating my ordeal, when I wrote it on my Twitter wall and said that I am going to publish this book, narrating my ordeal, Again, they came back for me. They had to hack my computer. They got the soft copy of it. If I could even publish, I'd actually, okay. I'd talked to my publisher. He had organized everything. He had given me some few virgin copies. The virgin copies just to prove that, you know, that everything is fine before they publish. So that is when they hack into my computer and they got the soft copy and they read it. Then again, they come and pick me. They come and arrest me.
For the second time, and this was September 18, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So now you say when you were being, you call it interrogated, but when you were being tortured and asked about the Greedy Barbarians, they wanted you to describe some of the characters. They particularly wanted to know if the main character was actually the Ugandan dictator, Yoweri Museveni. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, for readers, can you briefly tell us about that character, the Greedy Barbarian?
So, in the Greedy Barbarian, it is actually a work of imagination or fiction. But when you read, when you're reading it, you can actually think that it is a work about Mr. Museveni, Uganda's dictator, despot. Oh, definitely, you know, if you are a literature lover, if you have ever read Animal Farm, if you read Animal Farm, of course you can relate. You say that that Animal Farm is actually NRM, or it is Mr. Museveni and his family, or it is, you know, the people who are in charge of Uganda. So it is the same with my book. When you're reading my book, you say that, yeah, this is real Museveni. Actually, everyone who has read it is like, this is real Museveni. This is real Museveni. Though I did not mention him. I did not mention his name. Though okay, but
what are some of the things that the Greedy Barbarian does for listeners that we would like to know?
Yes. The person I wrote about, you know, practices, actually does vote rigging. Of course, Museveni rigs votes, does corruption, does extrajudicial killings, you know, arbitrary arrests, you know, is an outlaw, lawlessness, no rule of law, everything evil. And, you know, Dictator Museveni has done the worst. He has done everything I described in the book, even more.
And let me ask you, and it might not necessarily be only Jerome Museveni. There are many African rulers who fit that description, correct?
Yes.
But apparently, he took that as a very personal target to himself. It seems like.
Yes. Yes.
Is it because it's perhaps very convincing?
Maybe. Because actually people who have read my novel, most of them, they are telling me that seriously, you have told us a puzzle which has puzzled us for 30 years or 40 years. Yeah? So for me, I sat down and I imagined the story. So they are saying that I really mark correct Museveni's origin, you know. No one knows where he originated from, who gave birth to him, how he came to Uganda, you know, how he, you know, very many things. So everyone who reads it is like, now we understand the real Museveni, where he came from and really how, what he was before he became president. You know, how he manipulated his comrades and, you know, and he captured power.
34 years ago.
Yes.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI 99.5 FM radio. I am your host, Milton Ali Madi. Our guest today is Kakwenza Rukira Bashaida. He's a columnist for Black Star News, and he's also an author of two books in Uganda. We're discussing his recent arrest twice by the regime and the torture that he endured for writing those two books. Listeners, as you know, WBAI is able to bring you these types of shows and interviews because we are a commercial-free radio station. We don't take advertising. We get our support from listeners such as you. So I need to remind you to indeed go to WBAI. You can go to give, the number 2, and WBAI.org. That's how you can become a buddy, meaning you adopt one of our shows. And obviously, I hope Black Star News Show is one of your favorite shows, and the money is taken out of your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. You can also call 516-620-3602. And any contribution you make to WBAI will be put to very good use. Let me now go back to our guest, Kakwenza. Kakwenza.
Yes, sir.
So now, has this experience affected you as a writer? Are you perhaps a little more reluctant to write the kind of books that you've written so far, or even in your columns? What impact does this have?
Of course, this kind of torture, instead, it cannot whittle me down. Just instead, it encourages me to write more or to hate the dictatorship and to expose it more. So I am not actually threatened. I am not a coward. I cannot say that, no, let me stop writing because they will come back for me tomorrow. No. So I have to write more. I have to expose the dictatorship more.
So do you find yourself as a writer compelled to write? I mean, you cannot help but write because that's what you do. Is that also a consideration?
Because, you see, when you torture a writer, he breathes ink. So when they tortured me, when they arrested me and tortured me, they gave me what to write about. So the more they torture me, the more they bring their impunity on me, against me, the more I write their impunity. Their impunity on the paper, the more I document their impunity on the paper. So I am not threatened. If they feel like they want to keep on torturing me, that is, I will keep on writing against their impunity, about their impunity. I will keep exposing them.
But this has impact on your family as well, correct? I mean, you're married, you have young, is it a child or children, young children?
Yes, of course. I have 4 children. I have 1 wife. I take care of my family. I work for my family. Like, for example, when I was arrested and taken to the torture chamber for a whole month, I did not earn money. I actually went back as in economics. I did not, you know, by the time I was released, you know, I'm a farmer,
right.
I'm a full-time farmer and a student of law. So, by the time I was arrested, I was actually preparing the garden to sow, to plant the seeds. So when I was arrested, by the time I was released, the season had gone. So I did not, this season I did not harvest anything. I am just planting again. So as someone who survives on farming, once you miss a season, you're missing money.
Of course. Yes. Now, let me ask you this then. You have plans. I mean, I know there's still this bogus case going on against you, but you and your lawyer, do you have plans to sue the government for the damages? First of all, the physical and mental anguish they caused you, in addition to the damage from the economic losses. Is that in the plan?
Yes, it is. I was speaking with my lawyer and he's planning the suits.
Okay, now the other question is, Ugandan regime under Yoweri Museveni, who's been there for 34 years, is a major recipient of United States financial and military aid. I read a Washington Post article that had an estimate of $1 billion in annual U.S. financial support. So American taxpayers listening to this kind of ordeal that a Ugandan citizen endures with the support of U.S. taxpayers' dollars, and obviously you're not the only one. Many Ugandans are in this similar predicament, but we are focusing on your case now. So what do you say to American taxpayers who are listening to you speak today?
You see, it is very embarrassing that America, which is actually a champion of democracy, a champion of rule of law, you know, it is very embarrassing to find that they are, again, they are the ones who are supporting dictatorships. The more they support the dictatorships, the more the dictators keep on oppressing us. We are always oppressed. The oppressors, they are always oppressing us. The more they support Mr. Museveni with aid, and he misuses it, he goes and, you know, buys a family ambulance in form of an aircraft. He goes and gets military hardware, armory, and he starts, you know, suppressing freedom of expression, suppressing the opposition. Actually, we are just advising him, but he instead uses tear gas, uses bullets, guns, yeah, you know, against us. So it is really embarrassing that USA government is actually a culprit in the process of suppressing us, which actually they are supposed to be, okay, they are champions of rule of law and freedom of expression, democracy, but again, they are supporting dictatorship. So I don't know how they are benefiting.
Yes, so obviously it's very hypocritical. And I personally, of course, in the past, I've, on my previous programs, I've urged people to take action, which is one of the things you can actually do in this country. Call your elected representative and say, I don't want to be a part of this torture, not with my tax dollars. Now, as we are winding down toward the end of this first half hour, how can people get your book, first of all, The Greedy Barbarian, this book that has caused so much anguish to you, so much pain, but has also apparently enlightened many Ugandans and terrified the dictator? How can people get a copy of this book, The Greedy Barbarian?
The Greedy Barbarian is actually on Amazon, the Kindle version. Yes.
Okay, so it's on Amazon. What about this? What about the second book, Banana Republic, Where Writing is Treasonous? Is that going to be available on Amazon as well?
Yeah, it will be available actually next year in January. I was speaking with a publisher. He told me he will publish it there on in January.
Okay. Okay, and we've also been excerpting it. We've been serializing it, actually, on blackstarnews.com for listeners. So you can also go there, and you can also read Cacuenza's columns. And what about people that perhaps wanted to reach out to you to offer you solidarity, support, to show comradeship, and perhaps even to help you as you handle the legal cost of fighting this attack upon you by the regime? How can they get in touch with you?
They can write to me. My email is kakwenza.chilawashaija@gmail.com.
Could you spell that for listeners, please? Spell the email.
It is K, letter K, A, K, W, E, N, Z, A, R, U, KIRABASHAIJA.
JA, okay, very good. And
my mobile number.
Yes.
My mobile number is +256 785 367 367.
Okay, thank you so much. Any parting words? Any final word?
Maybe thank you so much for hosting me, Mr. Milton.
We thank you. Thank you so much. And we pray that you continue with your healing and that you stay safe. And obviously, we will revisit you again to see how your case is faring. Stay well, and good luck to you, and good luck to you and your family.
Thank you so much.
Brothers, comrades, welcome to the second half hour of Black Star News Show. I'm your host, Milton Alimadi. Our guest in the second half hour is a comrade and a friend, a lawyer, Candace Kelly. She is a frequent commentator on court TV, and she's also a media law professor at Rowan University. And we're going to be discussing the Breonna Taylor travesty. Welcome to Black Star News Show.
Milton, thank you. So good to be here, as always.
Okay, so let's get straight into it. This is one of the most dissatisfying non-decisions ever. I mean, because basically it tells me that Black folks have no right to self-defense, because the justification that the system, the establishment is trying to use is that the officers fired when Breonna's boyfriend fired at them and shot one of the officers. At this point, it's not even 100% definitive that he, in fact, did shoot one of the officers. Yes, he did fire Kenneth Walker. So that's the justification. So if somebody comes into your home and you hear the door being broken down, and you have a licensed firearm, and you use that for self-defense, and then you could still face the consequences. So explain that part first before we get into all the other details.
Milton, all of it is pretty laughable because it doesn't make sense. As you said, if that's the case, when we see somebody in plain clothes come into our homes, we can't defend ourselves. Because as you mentioned, Kenneth Walker, he actually went to jail. The murder charges, the charges against him were dropped. So how is this explained? Well, these no-knock warrant cases are how the attorney general and the prosecutor explain this. And what's interesting is that the attorney general in this case decided that this was self-defense, which is unusual and which is wrong. You need to go to court in order to prove that there was self-defense involved in terms of the officers thinking that they needed to defend themselves. So none of it makes sense at all, in that here you are sitting in your home. For all they knew, it's just three guys coming in to shoot them. Well, of course, if you're in your home, you are going to defend yourself. So how in the world could this attorney general say, well, the officers were defending themselves? And in fact, that's my determination. That's how grand juries go. In fact, the evidence that was presented in the grand jury, what was it? Well, we don't know. And that is the problem with grand juries. So first you have this issue of it being already determined that the police officers were acting in self-defense. And then we go into the grand jury room and we realize, you know what? We can't get in there. We don't even know the evidence that was presented in order to allow the grand jury to make the decision. And that's the problem. That's why people are in the streets now. I mean, they weren't in the streets for money, even though there was a $12 million judgment. They're in the streets for the records. Release the records, because we need to see what the prosecutor is doing. Is the prosecutor doing his job by presenting the very best evidence in order to allow the grand jury to make the best decision? But we don't know what evidence was given. And that's the problem. We need to get behind those closed doors. We need to change the grand jury portion of the criminal procedure and process.
If you were the prosecutor in this case, how would you have presented the evidence?
If I was the prosecutor, mm-hmm. yes. if I was a prosecutor in this case, and if I was working on behalf of what I thought was fair and just, then I would have to bring witnesses to the stand. I would have to bring boyfriend Kenneth Walker to the stand, other neighbors to the stand, and ask them, did you hear anybody knock? Did you hear anybody say anything? And then that would lead to the answer of no. You have to present the evidence that, you know, you're making the case. Here, it seems as though evidence was not presented. And because of that, the grand jury was able to do what they did. Now, the grand jury is an interesting process because, as I've said, prosecutors can present whatever they want. You don't know if it's even the truth or not, which is why they say that you can indict a ham sandwich, because you don't know what goes on behind closed doors. And the information that is given based upon the prosecutor, that's how the determination is given. But if I was a prosecutor and I was acting on behalf of the state, what you have to do is you have to bring everybody to the table. You have to bring all of the witnesses on both sides. You have to make your case as you would inside a regular courtroom that's open to the public. And therein lies the problem.
So is this the end of it in terms of the legal aspect for the officers? There's no other recourse?
No, this isn't the end of it. And that's another interesting thing. Normally, a civil judgment is given after a criminal judgment is given. Here, the $12 million that was given to Breonna Taylor's family was done in reverse order, which is interesting. It was kind of like, here's your money, go away, shut up. But that didn't happen. So what's going to happen now is now that there were not indictments for the shooting death of Breonna Taylor, what we're going to see is the FBI continue their federal investigation to see if there were any federal civil rights violations in this process. So that's where we are now. We're waiting for the FBI to pursue their course, and we are waiting and continuing to have people in the streets so that justice can act in the best interest of the people and those grand jury records are released. I think what's also interesting about this case is that when you're in the grand jury, it's a very informal process. Often in a regular trial jury that's open to the public, you are passing notes quietly, maybe because you have a question for the judge at the right time. In a grand jury, it's very, very relaxed. Witnesses can ask questions directly. I'm sorry, grand jury members can ask questions directly to the witness. There is no judge here. It's really the prosecutor who oversees what's going on. And that's why it's so peculiar in terms of what happened. What was this prosecutor thinking? And how did he work in conjunction with the attorney general to come up with what seems like a farce of information in order to lead to this particular result? I mean, if you are wantonly and recklessly shooting the next door neighbors, and that's what you're charged for, why wouldn't you be charged for that same thing in the death of Breonna Taylor? It just doesn't make any sense, because obviously it was, you know, wanton endangerment. Certainly you endangered her. For goodness sakes, you killed her. So of course that would be a final course of action, or so you would think. But in this case, it was not.
You preempted my question, actually. That was precisely what I was going to ask you. How could you be charged in the other instance and not in this instance? I mean, okay, if your defense was that you're acting in self-defense and you're targeting the person who was firing at you, well, you ended up killing somebody else.
Totally unrelated. And that shows the blatant disregard when brown and black bodies are laying on the ground and charges need to be pressed against police officers. And it doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. If that's the case, well, then who is responsible for her death? At that point, you are looking at the holes in the plaster of the wall, and you're determining, hey, you put other people in danger because of these bullet holes on the plastic walls. But in the meantime, Breonna Taylor is dead. Someone has to be responsible for that. You obviously thought that, even though the civil procedure is different, but someone did take the blame in terms of the financial aspect. What happened in this grand jury? And that's the question, and that's the verdict that's still out.
Now, I think I recall reading somewhere that the officers did not try to resuscitate her or to administer first aid.
Yes.
Is that not also?
I have seen reports from neighbors being interviewed on TV saying that they actually saw the officers not resuscitate Breonna Taylor. I've also seen reports noting that officers went into the crime scene without somebody accompanying them, which is the process. You normally leave the crime scene alone, and then you have somebody who accompanies you in order to gather all the evidence. But the police officers went and examined the body and stepped over the body and asked, okay, what's this gun? And does it look like there's a shotgun here? All of these things when they weren't even supposed to be in the room. And that's another issue. That procedure wasn't followed from the get. I mean, let's go back to the no search, to the no knock warrant. This was based on old information, right? So each step along the way, something wrong happened. And that's why we are where we are today.
So I take it that one of the reasons why you don't want them going in alone is because obviously there's been precedent in the past where officers compromise the evidence to lend itself in a certain direction.
Absolutely, where there is tampering of the evidence. One thing that a lot of people don't talk about is with these no-knock warrants is why do they even happen? And I neglected to point out that when monies are seized from illegal drug activities, parts of that money go to the police office and the department themselves. So there was a little over $1 million that went to the Louisville Police Department because of the seizure of illegal drug money. And so in terms of the no-knock warrant, this gives the opportunity, they say, for drug dealers not to flush something down the toilet or not to hide the money or not to do that. So that's why, this is something that has to be looked at in terms of what is the benefit here? Well, the benefit to the police department is that they get the money. They get the illegal money. It's not all of it, but it does fund part of the police department. And I think that that's an interesting part of it that hasn't been discussed a lot. This is how they fund the police, which is another reason why people are saying, well, let's defund it. Let's take a look at a different way of redistributing or reimagining the police system.
Okay, now in terms of the proceedings of the grand jury itself, there's been precedent where the evidence have been publicized or made public?
Yes.
And is there a chance that it might happen on this occasion? What is the process?
There is a chance that this might happen. In fact, the police officer who was charged himself, he has said, let's make this evidence reveal itself. Breonna Taylor's boyfriend has said, yes, I would like this evidence to be shown. So when you do have parties that are collaborating or agreeing on the same thing, then there is more of a likelihood that the evidence will be revealed. While on a federal level, the information is protected. If you have parties that do not mind that information be revealed, then you have more of a chance to do so. My guess is that the evidence, the grand jury proceedings, to a point, to an extent, will be revealed. The reason that we do have these grand jury proceedings that are protected is because we don't want to put anybody in harm's way. So to the extent that nobody's put in harm's way, my guess is that that evidence will reveal itself. My guess is that authorities will say, let's go ahead and share it, because both parties or parties involved do want that to happen. Even the party who was charged is saying, let's go ahead and do that.
Now, in terms of some of the statements that have been made, you say there's a FBI proceeding also ongoing. Have there been any statements from the attorney general, for example, or the prosecutors that you are concerned with that you think might actually impede that investigation?
So,
or prejudice the investigation?
There are many things that would prejudice this investigation. Quite frankly, the attorney general should have recused himself from this investigation because of his connection to Mitch McConnell, because of his connection to President Trump, and that his name was on the short list of potential Supreme Court justices. So he actually should have recused himself. That is problematic. What else is problematic is the fact that he said that these attorneys acted in self-defense. There was no trial to determine that. That was problematic. What else is also problematic is the fact that there have been many questions that have been asked of the Attorney General's office, and they refuse to answer, saying that everything is protected because it is a federal grand jury proceeding. That is problematic. There are a lot of open-ended questions that the office just is not answering. The prosecutor, too. So there's silence on their side in terms of the prosecutor and the Attorney General. And until we hear from them, we just don't know what was behind closed doors. We don't even know if the grand jury was given the consideration to say, did these police officers commit maybe negligent homicide or involuntary manslaughter? We don't even know if they were told, here are some of your options. All we got was this one particular charge of the wanton endangerment.
Let's say the evidence is publicized, made public, and some egregious missteps become obvious. This process is over, though, is it not? Or could that revelation actually intercede and allow another process? Is that not double jeopardy?
Right. It would not be double jeopardy, and that's a really good question. You would not hit the double jeopardy mark unless somebody was actually tried. And in this case, nobody was even actually charged for maybe negligent homicide or involuntary murder. So in that particular case, double jeopardy would not apply. And so that if there was some appearance of impropriety that turned out to be an impropriety, if there was conflict of interest, if somebody can prove that there was bias, if somebody can prove that their civil rights were in fact negated by something that happened in the process, oh, these officers can find themselves in court again. Absolutely.
So it is a big deal.
It's a very, very big deal. It's also one of those things where if we look at what's going on in the streets, this is where the people have spoken to say, this is what we want to see happen. And we've seen so much of that. And the more people that are out on the streets and continue to protest, continue to march, continue to say, I am Breonna Taylor, then the more the justice system will respond. And we've seen that. It's a very interesting and delicate time because everybody's at home. It's the election year, the Supreme Court justice. People are really paying attention so much more in terms of their rights, that this is going to be a different fight. People are taking over towns, cities, and they are saying, if you don't give us what we want, we won't give you what you want. And that is the peace that you want out in the streets. We're going to protest. We're going to make our voices be heard. You thought that this was just going to be one Instagram post or one post or one interview? No, these people want to see people removed from the bench. Already, the no-knock warrant has been abolished in the state of Kentucky. It makes it the third state to do so. Most states do have it. But from March to June, people were able to take to the streets and change that.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Black Star News Show on WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM radio. I am your host, Milton Alimadi. My guest today is lawyer Candace Kelly. She is also a professor of media law at Rowan University. And we're discussing the Breonna Taylor travesty. Listeners, you know WBAI does not have any commercials, and that's how we're able to do it, with your support. So I'm asking you to pick up the phone and dial 516-620-3602. Any contribution we will put to good use. You can even do better. You can become a WBAI buddy. And if you've been considering becoming a buddy in the name of Black Star News Show, and if you're not sure, well, I am telling you today, yes, become a buddy. You can do so by going to give, and then the number 2, and then WBAI.org. Let me go back to our guest now. All right, so you seem to be quite optimistic in terms of the impact of these marches. And yes, of course, we've already seen some significant changes. I think most states, most municipalities are discussing some level or some form of police reform.
Yes.
Go ahead. Talk about that.
Yeah, they are discussing some level of police reform. Even federally, we have national police reform. I think one of the things with this Breonna Taylor case, for example, is the fact that the no-knock warrants that was changed, that perhaps bringing someone along on the route when you go out and you are responding through these calls, that's a change. So there are changes that people will have to look for. We have to see if anything sticks. But these are the types of changes that have been put on the table in terms of Louisville, Kentucky. What is it that we need to do? Well, we need to keep our eye out for things that were said to have been changed and make sure that they have happened. Police officers, in terms of living in the own community where they work, that's now a requirement too, to require police officers to be familiar with the people so they can talk with the people. So there won't be this fractured relationship between both. So those are the things that are on the table when we look at the $12 million settlement. Along with that were these descriptions or these things that I told you that would happen, changes that should be made. We just have to make sure that they are made.
So this also confirms that we can never really underestimate the power of people coming out to the streets and really becoming active.
It
just confirms how powerful the whole Black Lives Movement has been over the last few years.
It has. And, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, when it started, it was and still is a very strong movement. But what happened is that once we saw laws being changed, regulations being changed, and more people with their video cameras telling the stories that are out there, that's when we really saw people get on board in terms of financially, in terms of really understanding, in terms of white people too, getting on board. See, because this is a process where we need white people. Oh, understand that we need white faces in the streets protesting, especially white young faces, in order to make the point that justice needs to happen. Because these young white women and men, they're going home to their parents or they're speaking to them and they're sharing with the older generation what is going on. So you see this sharing of information so that everybody understands that this is important. And with the pandemic, everybody is paying attention to it. They know about all of this. We hear about all of this all the time, but normally we're at our offices from 9 to 6 or 9 to 8. But now people are really able to pay attention to it. So it's the protests, it's the pandemic, it's the election. People are looking at their circumstances to try to figure out what is going on. How do all these moving parts fit together? And then where can I fit in? So yes, we need the people in the streets, but we need people of color, people of non-color, in order to make it happen. Just like the civil rights movement, it's everybody. Because what happens is that when we talk about civil rights, when we talk about Black Lives That Matter, we are talking about other issues that come to the table that people see themselves on par with. So people talk about civil rights and gay rights and women's rights, kind of all on the same level. Now, some people would agree or disagree to do that. But because people are doing that, they see themselves in Black Lives Matter. And as a Black woman, I see myself in Breonna Taylor. That could have been me. When I walk down the street, I know that's what people see. They see a Breonna Taylor. Even when I open my mouth, the microaggressions and the racism that comes in my area when I'm just minding my own business, that's something that I know Breonna saw, and that's something that every Black woman, no matter her pedigree, no matter where she lives, no matter how much she makes, is experiencing the exact same thing. So we all identify on it. We all are doing our part in order to make sure that the voices are heard.
All right, final question. You mentioned the election. Tell listeners why this is not just an election this time around.
This is not just an election because we have somebody that is in office that is going to do all he can to steal the election. No matter what the outcome will be, it will be stolen because this is someone who has already been planting the seeds for months that this election is wrong, that this election is not going to be fair or honest, and he is changing minds out there. This election is also important because of the clock that he had to beat in order to put a Supreme Court justice in that seat with Amy Coney Barrett. This election is important because of the Affordable Care Act and the Supreme Court decision that's going to be made or heard, the argument that's going to be heard on November 10th, and whether or not people will have the same access to the Affordable Care Act and the benefits that come with it. This is an important election because of the absentee ballot and the mail service and the postal service. There are so many moving parts that it's hard to really prioritize. This is an important election because of the pandemic, because people are still out there without their masks. And if you believe that masks are saving lives, you are correct. But there is one person who believes that that is not a priority, which is why we are now today seeing some of the highest numbers in New York and New Jersey for months in terms of those who have caught COVID.
On that note, tell listeners how they can get in touch with you, and everybody wanted to continue this conversation with you.
Yes, absolutely. You can get in contact with me. I like emails. I'm CandaceKelly@gmail.com. CandaceKelly@gmail.com.
And that's all the time we have today. Listeners, make sure you follow me at Ali Mahdi on Twitter, and also visit BlackStarNews.com. Thanks again to our guest, and we'll have you back soon. Be well.
Thank you, Melton.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amar Evering with some brief news headlines. Donald Trump and Joe Biden will square off tonight for the first of three planned presidential debates. The 90-minute showdown will be divided into six segments, which are the records of Trump and Biden, the U.S. Supreme Court, the coronavirus pandemic, the economy, election integrity, and, quote, race and violence in U.S. cities. Fox News anchor Chris Wallace will moderate tonight's debate at Case Western University in Cleveland. Ahead of the debate, Democrats have demanded that Wallace correct Trump when he makes false claims. But Wallace, who Trump has called, quote, nasty and obnoxious, said he will not perform a fact-checking function. WPFW and WBAI will be carrying the debate live, followed by analysis, until 11:30 p.m. tonight. A Washington Post review of 90 state and federal voting lawsuits have found that judges appointed by both Republicans and Democrats have been, quote, broadly skeptical of arguments before the courts that point to voter fraud, with no judge endorsing Trump's argument that voter fraud poses a significant risk to the credibility of the November election. This comes as many high-profile cases about mail-in voting are being decided in American courts. So far, GOP lawyers have scored several wins related to mail ballots, such as maintaining North Carolina's witness requirement. A third federal judge ordered UPS to stop changes that are delaying mail delivery nationwide. District Judge Emmett G. Sullivan sided with a collection of 15 voters and voter registration groups who argued that mail delays could deny thousands of people the right to vote. He also sided with three states and the cities of New York and San Francisco in opposing UPS changes on procedural grounds. Sullivan wrote that, quote, the potential for voter disenfranchisement is immense, end quote, in the 28 states that require ballots to be received by Election Day. President Trump's 2016 campaign identified more than 3 million black voters it wanted to deter from casting ballots in the presidential election, according to a massive data leak obtained by the British news outlet Channel 4. The leak revealed that the campaign compiled data of nearly 200 million voters and divided them up into 8 different categories. 54% of the people on the, quote, deterrent list were people of color, according to Channel 4. The campaign worked with the controversial British data firm Cambridge Analytica, now defunct, to compile the data, which was used to target certain Facebook ads to voters. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said on Monday that census counting will end next week on October 5th, in defiance of a federal judge ruling last week, which said census operations should carry on as previously planned through the end of October. The Trump administration last month moved forward the deadline by 1 month to September 30th. On Monday, the California judge overseeing the case said she was, quote, disturbed by Ross's announcement and ordered the government to respond by today with its justification for shortening the census count. The results of the census influenced the division of $1.5 trillion in federal funding, as well as determine how many congressional seats each state receives. Top officials at the White House pressured leaders at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to downplay the risk of coronavirus to children as President Trump's administration pushed to reopen schools this fall. Citing documents and interviews with current and former government officials, the New York Times reported today the push included an effort to find data suggesting the pandemic was weakening and the coronavirus did not threaten children. Olivia Troy, a former member of Vice President Mike Pence's staff, who has since resigned, told the Times she was asked on more than one occasion by Mark Short,